Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro. This week, I'm giving you a sneak peek into the making of my new TV series coming to public television stations nationwide starting in April. America the Bountiful explores the diverse cultures and history of our nation by using food as both a tour guide and a storyteller. I'm excited to be joined by my partner in the adventure of making this show, Jesse Raisler. Jesse is a James Beard Award-winning filmmaker whose work has appeared on the Food Network Digital, Magnolia Network, and Tastemade, just to name a few. So I am so honored that Jesse is the director and fellow executive producer of America the Bountiful. This show would not be what it is without collaborating with Jesse. His creative eye, experience, and that of his talented team at the Minneapolis-based production company Credo Nonfiction is what has helped create and bring America the Bountiful to life. So without further ado, Jesse, welcome to Eat Your Heartland Out.
Oh, thank you for the kind introduction. I've been excited for this conversation, and it's what, gosh, 4 or 5 years in the making actually now, almost.
It is. And my gosh, it has been a journey. It is, you know, talk about it's a marathon and not a sprint. We'll give maybe a little bit of context to our listeners, about kind of, you know, sort of the origin story of America the Bountiful. Way back when, in gosh, 2019, I was doing some writing for Food Network Digital and, was speaking to the main editor at that time and shared with her that I had some ideas about, you know, potentially doing a program that would try to tell our nation's story through the lens of food. You know, I had a couple ideas about, you know, food history, culinary history, agritourism, kind of bring them all together. She had suggested, well, you know, here's a couple different people to maybe talk to share your ideas and see if there's an opportunity for collaboration. And I knew from the first time I spoke with Jesse at Credo that it was the right fit. And I don't know if it's the Midwestern thing or what, but I have to bring that up since this is a show about food and culture in the Midwest. So we got to talk about that Midwestern route.
Heck yeah. No, there's a connection right from the beginning. I think because we were both such big food geeks and food history geeks, I mean, that's not tremendously common in the world of television. There's a few of us, but again, like you said, I think also that Midwestern roots, we just have a way of communicating and relating and, you know, talking about making things in a way that's, you know, it has a certain work ethic and a genuineness that I think comes through. So, yeah, I think the Midwestern roots are definitely a big part of that connection.
No question about it. And that's kind of where, you know, as we started this process, you know, brought to the table the concept of doing the pilot in Wisconsin, which couldn't have been a better fit for me and for this show. Folks will be able to see the pilot, which is not the first episode in the series, by the by, but it is Wisconsin. And that's where you grew up, right?
Yeah, so I grew up in Wausau, Wisconsin, you know, smaller town right in the central part of the state. I grew up in the countryside near Wausau, I should say. So I'm a country kid and recently moved back to the country. So once a country kid, back to a country kid. Now that I have kids, we brought them out here too. But yeah, Wisconsin holds a strong place in my heart. I did live in Minneapolis for quite a few years, and we also have an office for our production company there. So I make that trek often. But yeah, Wisconsin is my home.
And I will tell you, like, I was so blown away by Wisconsin and, you know, as our first opportunity to, you know, bring this, this concept to life and bringing together, you know, these stories about, a place, but, you know, telling them through food. And Wisconsin was such a great place to start this journey because, you know, you think about what is Wisconsin known for, you know, the Green Bay Packers and their cheese heads, right? It's America's Dairyland. Mm-hmm. It's on the license plate. And then of course, it's a big beer state. Everybody knows that too. And so those two things served as our tour guide and, you know, it was a really fun way to show, how, you know, the German and Swiss immigrant experience shaped the culinary palate of today's Wisconsin.
Absolutely. I would say the culinary palate and also just like the hospitality, right? Mm-hmm. Like we talk about in the episode, that warm feeling you get when people are gathering around a table for food and for drink, whether it's
what was that German word I couldn't pronounce, Jesse?
Gemütlichkeit. Yes.
There it is.
Yes, that is the warm feeling. Is. Yep, exactly right. Mm-hmm.
That took more than one take. For sure.
that was one of them. The other one was the Glarner Stube, right?
Oh, yes. Glarner Stube, which yum, yum, yum. You know, one of the best things so as well about this show is the amazing things that you get a chance to taste. You know, but for me, and I'm sure for you, I mean, it's about the people. I mean, it's about the people.
Absolutely.
And the stories that they can tell, because you know, I think we share the same vision for this show that food is this very accessible way to tell a story. It's something that people relate to. Everybody likes it. It's a unifier. And so it's this wonderful entry point to have a conversation about culture and about, you know, things, you know, kind of challenging aspects of our American history too. I mean, we touch on enslaved people in Virginia. We talk about Japanese internment, you know, and the family in Oregon that ended up having to turn over their pear orchard while they were in the internment camps. I mean, you know, so we have some really interesting, you know, Black land ownership and supporting Black, growing Black farmers and Black businesses in Georgia. I mean, so there's definitely fun in these shows, but there's also a lot of teachable moments. And I feel like they're only can be done through food. And this, at least that's our vision here.
No, absolutely. I mean, I've always felt food is such an accessible gateway into our culture and our history, and where those things overlap is such fertile ground for this type of storytelling. And you get to learn, you know, those aspects while learning maybe how to cook something you haven't tried before, or make something at home, or a place you can visit to sample something that has an amazing story behind it. And I worked a lot of years with Andrew Zimmern on his Bizarre Foods show. And something he always would say is like, good food is great, but good food with a story is better. So the story helps you appreciate those things even more.
Absolutely. I love that quote. And Andrew, thanks to you, was in our Minnesota episode about wild rice. And he was an incredible tour guide. I can't think of a better person to bring us around the Minnesota State Fair than Andrew Zimmern, who was an absolute joy and a privilege to work with. And it was a little, I will tell you, I was definitely a little nervous and stressed out. I'm like, okay, this guy is a legend. And like, I now have to like sit next to him and talk and look like I know what I'm doing. And so, you know, that was a little bit stressful, but I think it turned out okay.
Oh, I love listening to, you know, seeing and listening to the two of you chat together. I think it was a great meeting of minds, and he's one of the original, you know, food travelogue TV makers, you know, and there's a reason he's done it for so long. I mean, it's incredible to watch him work, but yeah, when the two of you got together, I loved how you conversed. And, I think that segment at the fair is, you know, still one of my favorites because the energy the two of you bring together is really fantastic.
I totally agree. You know, and thinking about that episode also makes me think about, you know, some fun behind the scenes moments that you were not actually there for, but I have to share for our listeners, but is still, you know, in the cornerstone of the wild rice episode, where we go out and we harvest wild rice. And, you know, we had to kind of go and, you know, nature, this show is like kind of hosted. It's not hosted by me. It's hosted by Mother Nature in many ways. And if the stuff's not on the trees or in the water or, you know, growing, you got an issue. So we had to work with our guides from the Ojibwe, right? Community there. Yep. In northern Minnesota, who were absolutely incredible. And we got to have a chance to experience how, you know, traditional ways in which they harvested wild rice, but we had to go to where the wild rice was. And, you know, there are no road signs. We got lost. There's no GPS, but all that aside, so it's August and it is hot. And I am canoeing the boat while the crew is in the front of the boat. And I am just sweating and my face is red and I'm like canoeing. And not all shows, as you well know, but our listeners don't, like, are necessarily shot in order. This was the last thing that we shot, and it's the first episode the first scene of the episode. And I'm like, well, this is great. I'm sweating, I'm a mess, I'm canoeing. And guess what? That's how we're gonna open this show. Fantastic.
Yeah, and you had to travel quite a ways too to actually find the rice, right?
Yeah. So the first place that we intended on going didn't have there was a storm apparently came through the night before, and, you know, kind of changed the trajectory of everything, which is why we had to go someplace else. So it was a very long production day. The whole crew that was out there that day were absolute champs, and our hosts, you know, were incredible, and. You know, really, it's these sort of opportunities are like a once in a lifetime thing. I mean, the fact that I got a chance to go out and harvest wild rice with sticks with folks in the Ojibwe Nation, showing and sharing with me their, you know, their traditional harvesting methods. It's an honor. And it's a wonderful opportunity to share those experiences with others that might not necessarily get to go there, but maybe they see it and they want to learn more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's such a special episode. And I think another moment like that jumps out in a similar way in my mind is the Ramps episode in West Virginia.
Yeah.
You know, you're so often like in the moment, at least for me, you know, my head's in the monitor, making sure, okay, we covered off on all these story points. The angles are looking great. Do we need pickups? And then once in a while, you can take a, you know, step back and take a breath and go like, wow, look where we are. Look what this person, where this person has brought us. Look what's happening. This is so magical and special. And that was the case when Jason brought us out. We had collected ramps and he had some morel mushrooms and he brought us to this streamside rock where he had put a fire pit and cooked up this streamside meal in West Virginia. And it's just one of those things where the food was so linked to the place. And here we were experiencing it in this place with all this history, with this amazing guide. He was such a wonderful, you know, cook and educator. You know, he's just so natural about it. And what a special afternoon and evening that was. I'll never forget that.
Absolutely. No, that really was incredible. And, you know, just going out there and, you know, getting those ramps. And for folks that might not necessarily be familiar with ramps, first of all, tune into the Ramps episode in West Virginia, where you will be surprised by things like ramp ice cream. But it's basically kind of like an onion garlic hybrid. I was surprised by how many people that aren't familiar with foraging or are not from maybe a region that has ramps aren't familiar with ramps. And so they're like a little piece of almost heaven in this case with West Virginia, pun intended. It's, you know, you go out and you can take these, you know, these little kind of small bulbs out of the ground and you can use all of them, you know, and they make an incredible meal and an enhancement and just shows you what you can get from the land. But that was definitely, I feel like there was a lot of fog involved and a lot of dust involved in that episode too. So yeah, that was a little, we could have, you know, a, a behind the music, as I like to say. I show my age with that.
Right.
Like on pretty much like every single aspect of these. But it's just been such a joy to work with you because you have a great eye for composition and for content, but also, you know, being able to set that stage to get those right moments that are authentic and aren't, I don't know how to put it, like overproduced. I feel like that's like your special sauce. Like you let it happen. And I think to your earlier point, I think that, you know, your vision helps that authenticity shine.
Well, thank you for that. No, I think that's the documentary filmmaking background coming through. You know, I've been involved in a fair amount of TV, but much more so documentary before that. And, you know, it's always about making someone who isn't normally on camera feel comfortable with the mechanics of film and television making, because there's all of a sudden there's cameras and there's a lot more people than there usually is. So how do you try to minimize that and strip that away? And it's really just, you know, being a good listener when you first talk to these folks. You know, when we're doing our outreach and casting, it's, you know, listening to what they have to say about how they normally go about, whether it's the harvest or cooking or enjoying this food, and then setting up that situation so that it's familiar to them and they feel comfortable. And then kind of getting out of the way, letting that happen, maybe guiding a little bit in terms of where we set up or the order of things, but letting them do things as they would. And then you have such a great way of making them feel comfortable and drawing out, you know, their story from them in a way that we know we want to sort of put it together. So we're hitting all those key points as we go, but really just putting them in a place that they're familiar with and making them feel comfortable. And, you know, just trying to let things unfold as much as we can organically as they do is how we approach it.
Yeah. I feel like sometimes it's easier said than done, but you make it look very, very easy. And I think you bring up a really good point. You know, you said that you mentioned the fact that, you know, you want to make people feel comfortable that aren't necessarily on camera. And while we mentioned Andrew Zimmern for a moment earlier, he is the exception to the rule. We do have some names in this show for sure, but so many of the people that are on the show are people. You know, they're your neighbor. Yeah. They're people that are multi-generational farmers, or, you know, they're out there doing the work. I mean, and you know, where I was thinking about, we did cranberries in Massachusetts. There was and we went out to a multi-generational family farm that was harvesting the cranberries, and they had some sort of equipment breakdown. And like the husband had to go deal with that. You know, and like, it's like, you know, you have to recognize we're on their land and their time, right? And this is real life. And you got to go deal with equipment. Like, that's what you got to do, because, you know, the business isn't going to run if you don't go do it. But people are, you know, I think that's one of the things that makes this show special, is that these are real people. And I think that it's just so important that we amplify these kind of stories. Because it's what makes our country, you know, great, and gives us those contours to our tapestry. What do you hope viewers come away from when they take a look at the show?
Well, I think it offers so much, and I think what I'm most proud of is, you know, a lot what you referenced there, in that you know, a lot of these people, places, stories are a little bit off the beaten path. There's a lot of rural, a lot of small town storytelling happening, that so much of the food media is focused on the coast or the big cities or the high-end restaurants. And, you know, we sprinkle a few of those in there too, because there might be an interesting new take on an old tradition. But for the most part, I think we're going out to where these traditions originated, and the fact that you can get a sense of history and how culture shaped the food, but then food shaped the culture, is really fascinating. But then also there's these takeaways, like, you know, I've cooked things, you know, I had friends, we have an annual get together with like my best buddies in the world from high school and college. And, I don't think I even told you this. I made a batch of the chili relenos from the Chili's episode in New Mexico.
That's fantastic.
So I found a bunch of the peppers and stuffed them and did them the same way he did, battered and then on the plancha. And so I think that's the other thing, is you can come away and go like, oh, that not only is this fascinating, but that looks delicious. I want to try this. And then you can go find whatever the food is and either, you know, cook what you saw on the show or do your own take on it. So not only is it an interesting takeaway, you're entertained, but you can also at the end of that cook something and share it with your family. So I think that's really, really fun too.
I totally agree. I love that, that you, you know, went out and did that from the New Mexico Chili's episode. You know, for me, that was, the South Dakota pheasant Marcella. Pheasant is obviously not necessarily something you can get all the time. But you know, because of the way that, the chef David made it, you know, and I paid very close attention to the cold butter and, you know, the amount of, you know, Marcella wine he used and when he put in the mushrooms, all that stuff. I will like try to commit it all to memory. So then even if I'm not having pheasant at home, which by the way, I didn't know what to expect from eating pheasant. It was fantastic. And I think every place we went in South Dakota where we were had an opportunity to eat pheasant was prepared beautifully, different ways, but all wonderful. But that pheasant Marcella, I was like, okay, I might not be able to have pheasant, but I can do a chicken Marcella like this. And, you know, it's gonna make everybody happy. You know, same thing with, I think pudding chômeur in Vermont for maple, another great one, that I definitely was, you know, tarte au sucre as well. I love maple. So a lot of the maple stuff, definitely, came back with me, but you're right. It's a great way. And, you know, for people to learn a little bit more and take something away to share with their own friends and family. And then hopefully also maybe get inspired to, you know, learn more about a place or, you know, a certain thing that, you know, they saw on the episode. And maybe even get out there and drive, as we say, those back roads, because, you know, why take my word for it when America the Bountiful is waiting for you and me?
Absolutely. That's the other takeaway, right? Like, and it's so funny you brought up pheasant Marcella, because that's the one other thing I've cooked for this time. It was for family back home, because you so graciously let my dad was so excited. He's wanted a pheasant hunt for years. And I asked Capri, I said, would you mind if he came out? We need extras anyway. And you said, of course. So he did. And
absolutely.
Had a blast and loved it. Yeah.
It was awesome.
He had
he was
so
awesome.
Much fun. And it was so great for me to be able to experience that. I think he like kind of, you know, he's kind of understood what I do, but to have him actually on set like meant a lot. But then also he went out pheasant hunting apart from us and brought a few home. And then he brought those over to our house like a month later. He had frozen them and we made that exact dish, the pheasant Marcella dish. But so that's one takeaway. But then you're right. Like I already know when I take my boys out to Oregon, we're going to go to Gordy's Orchard and see him. We're going to go have the pear pizza, you know, down the road.
Pizza.
And so it can serve. So it can serve not only as like you get these takeaways to cook, but it can serve as a travel map, and it's places that you might not hear about anywhere else because it is these small farms that are doing something interesting, like they were there with, you know, doing the pizzas on site from the pears grown right in their orchard. So yeah, there's that aspect of it too, which is really fun.
That oh yeah, for sure. Now before I let you go, we want to give us a little bit of a sneak peek to season two, which my goodness, I don't know how it's already happening, but you know, it's like, it took 4.5 years for us to get here. And now we're like off to the races and we're going right back out to this thing is not going to even be on the air in certain places for more than like 2 weeks. And we're going to be back out there. So, what do we have on the horizon? We've been comparing notes and, you know, doing research, both of us, and, you know, we always kind of like do our thing and then come back together and oftentimes find that my list and your list always have some overlap of you know, research and subjects and people and places. And, any particular things that you're really looking forward to in season two?
Gosh, I mean all of it, but the first two in particular, like, are we allowed to say what we're featuring at this point?
No one has said anything otherwise. I mean, I think we can like talk in generalities, if nothing else, maybe not specific people, but
So, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a big forager. I've been hunting mushrooms for a long, long time, but specifically during COVID when we had a lot of downtime. You know, there wasn't a lot of production work. I made a show about foraging with a chef that was also not working because restaurants were closed. And I learned so much from him, not just about mushrooms, but plants, but mushrooms are sort of my first love in that regard. So I love going out hunting wild mushrooms. I love cooking with mushrooms. So mushrooms being at the top of the list here, and being able to go even a little bit deeper on some of the science and ecology of some of these foods. Yeah. I think in season two will be really interesting, with mushrooms in particular, talking about cultivated mushrooms and wild mushrooms and mm-hmm. how they're different, and how some mushrooms can't be cultivated. You have to go find them in the wild, or at least not yet, and how that can be really special and the different flavors. So as a mushroom geek, I am so excited for that first outing in particular.
That is gonna be awesome. I I am not near the level of mushroom geek that you are, but I love mushrooms, and I feel like they're one of these things where people either love them or hate them. They have like a texture issue. I happen to love mushrooms. Yep. But we are going to the mushroom capital of the world. It has an interesting cultural story as well, which you guys will have to tune in for next season. But, I think there'll be a lot of surprises in, you know, what made the mushroom capital of the world, and kind of what its origin story is, and how different ethnic and immigrant groups came to get involved in the industry and, you know, continue, particularly on the cultivated side. So that is going to be a lot of fun. And then I know we got one lined up right after that too. So I know that you mentioned that one's exciting to you as well.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. So, crawfish. I mean, I have a personal history there. Like we would catch crawdad. We call them crawdads, same species, but we call them crawdads. We catch them out of the stream. My family's original farmland, which is now hunting land in the family since I was very little. But I've also been to Louisiana and New Orleans a bunch of times, and just like love everything about the Cajun and Creole culture. So mm-hmm. I think doing a deep dive on crawfish, and particularly within that culture, is going to be really, really fun. And getting out there in the river basin where there's the wild, and then again, looking at how there's been innovations in how crawfish are also farmed with this sort of symbiotic relationship with rice fields too, is going to be really, really interesting.
I'm glad you brought that up. I think the rice field thing is so interesting to me. The fact that, you know, these places that, you know, folks harvest both the crawfish and the rice, and, you know, the cycle that goes through is just absolutely fascinating. And I think that is something else that, you know, we've tried to touch upon in season one, but I think we are going to end up probably integrating more of in season two about the ecology and the sustainability and a number of these different, you know, techniques to ensure that our food system continues as well, and what it means to continue to preserve our food system and ultimately the foodways that a number of these communities and cultures across our country have worked so hard to put on our tables. This has been so meaningful for me to have you on, and I know you're so busy because America the Bountiful is not the only thing you do. So to take some time and share with us has just really been wonderful to walk a little bit of down memory lane, and looking forward to getting out there and sharing the road on season two. And can't believe we're going to be able to turn on our TVs and actually see this. It's crazy.
I can't wait. I'm so grateful that fate brought us together back when it did. And this has been such an amazing journey, and it's been just so wonderful to see this all come to life, and I can't wait to share it with everybody. So thank you.
Absolutely. Me too. Thank you, Jesse Raisler. Thank you for joining Eat Your Heartland Out. See you on the road.
This is Eat Your Heartland Out with me, Capri Cafaro. After the break, get ready for some select interviews from the Eat Your Heartland Out archives from folks who are also featured on America the Bountiful. Stick around.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills, combined with the freshest milk available, created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheese making craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro. Before the break, I was speaking with Jesse Raisler, director and fellow executive producer of America the Bountiful, a new travel and history series coming to public television stations nationwide starting in April. Now I'm digging into the Eat Your Heartland Out archives because there's some guests that have been featured on this show that you'll also see on America the Bountiful. Sean Sherman is one of those guests. Also known as the Sioux Chef, S-I-O-U-X, Sean Sherman was one of the first people I interviewed for Eat Your Heartland Out back in 2020. We discussed indigenous food sovereignty, seed saving, and Sean's work as a chef and cookbook author. Fast forward a few years, and Sean joined us for our episode about wild rice in Minnesota. We visited his groundbreaking restaurant, Awamni. And after interviewing Sean for this show, it was exciting to meet him in person and amplify his voice and story as part of America the Bountiful. Take a listen to part of my conversation with Sean Sherman from 2020. Sean, we are fired up and ready to go and really excited to have you on the show.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Absolutely. You have an incredible story, and I want you to tell the audience a little bit about your background and roots to put your journey into context.
Sure. So I was born and raised on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. I'm a member of the Oglala Lakota Sioux tribe. All my family was from the reservation. And my mom moved my sister and I off the reservation when I was just before high school age. And I started working in restaurants at a pretty young age. I started working when I was barely 13. And I worked through all my high school and college career. And then after college, I moved to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And within a few short years, I worked my way up into an executive chef position in the city and never really turned back. So I've been a chef for quite a long time now. And a few years into that chef career, I had this epiphany of doing what I'm doing today, which is really a focus on North American indigenous foods. And a lot of that was a realization of just seeing that there was almost no indigenous anything in the culinary world around right. the United States or anywhere. So I really wanted to get to the bottom of what that meant to me and my ancestors.
So, I mean, you're absolutely correct. And I think that anyone would agree that there is, you know, that the indigenous foodways is woefully absent from the culinary discussion anywhere and is really absent from plates, you know, whether they're in your kitchen or, you know, in a restaurant, which is why I find this so important to talk about as we, you know, really delve into what Midwestern foodways are, because there is such a history and heritage that is connected with the indigenous foodways. And I know that in part of your work, you have done a lot in tracing the migration of seeds. So you're literally going back to, you know, the actual heart of how these things, you know, how seeds basically migrated across North America or maybe came from a different place and how all of this connects together. I would really, you got to tell us about how you got into tracing the migration of seeds and what that means to the larger picture of, you know, telling the story of indigenous foodways.
Yeah, I mean, I was always interested in history in general and food history for that matter, especially being in the chef field. And when I started studying indigenous foods, you know, I really wanted to know what were my ancestors eating? What were they harvesting? Were they growing things? Who were they trading with? How were they storing foods? And all those kinds of questions. And agriculture is such an amazing piece of North American history because it
Absolutely.
Dates so far back, you know. And we look at North American indigenous foodways, where our focus is North America, like I said. So it's we look at Mexico all the way through Alaska and all of this amazing history. So you look at corn production and it starts way in the southern edges of Mexico and shoots both directions into the Americas, you know, both north and south. So it crawls all the way up throughout all of Mexico, through the entire entire Caribbean, through the entire Eastern Seaboard, up the Mississippi and Missouri River Valleys, so far up into areas like where I'm at in Minnesota, and even further north than me in some areas, and basically everywhere from here to the East Coast, you know. And there's so much cool seeds that are still alive out there. So we see all this wonderful, diverse collection of corns and beans and squash and sunflower seeds and amaranth and chili peppers further in the south. And there's just so much cool stuff to see. And like, again, like we're lucky that we have so much of this diversity still alive today of these heirloom strains, you know. And but it's something that's really important because we've also lost a lot of seeds over the, you know, past time period. And we're doing everything we can to showcase how valuable those seeds are.
So you just said showcase how valuable they are. How do you showcase these seeds and integrate them into the dishes that you make?
Well, there's been a lot of effort in Indian country across the U.S. and Canada, and people are really working hard towards indigenous food sovereignty, and seed sovereignty is a big part of that. So getting some of these seeds that date so far back and they have direct links to very specific regions and people and cultures, and being able to see these seeds growing in those regions people being able to disperse them. And for us in the restaurant and food industry, you know, we're able to work directly with a lot of these indigenous farmers and be able to showcase and create even new recipes using some of these amazing pieces. But it's a constant study in the history of these foods and what we can do with them and how we can utilize them today.
Well, I want to ask you about some of the new recipes you're working on to again showcase some of these ingredients. But before that, I do want to make sure that our listeners understand what food sovereignty is. It might not be a terminology that everybody is aware of. So could you elaborate on what food sovereignty means to you and what it usually means in this kind of context?
Yeah, I mean, food sovereignty really is, especially with indigenous communities, tied to food security. And it's looking at how indigenous peoples lost so much food security, especially during the 1800s and 1900s, and being removed from their own foodways. So it's all about these indigenous communities having the ability to kind of manage their foods for themselves and to really grow their production of the foods so they could really be secure, you know, because they need to have access to the food. They need to be able to produce them. They need to be able to mandate their own rules around them. And we just want to see that happening more and more because these are really healthy foods and they have very special connections to indigenous peoples. And we just really want to help create a better situation than what's out there today, especially among indigenous communities where they suffer from so much food insecurity. And we see, you know, really horrible rates of diabetes, obesity, heart disease, and all of this disease that's happening directly from malnutrition and poor food access.
Right. I mean, there's no question that food sovereignty can be part of the puzzle of solving some of those, terrible epidemics that you see amongst indigenous people in North America. I know that, you know, in your work, you do a lot to support native farmers, growers, and food entrepreneurs. Tell me a little bit more about that work, since we're now on this topic.
Yeah, of course. So as a food producer here in the city, you know, and we're focused on indigenous foods and regional indigenous foods on top of that. So when we started our work way back in 2014, officially being out there in the market, we started utilizing and focusing on using only indigenous foods. So we cut out colonial ingredients of things that didn't exist here before.
Like
things
what?
Like wheat flour, like dairy, like processed cane sugar, even beef, pork, and chicken, because all those pieces haven't been in these lands for that long, and we wanted to showcase all of this different food. So it was a huge study of wild foods and the agriculture, like we talked about, but also wild game and birds and fish. And there's just so much to explore out there, you know? So we think it's really exciting for people to learn what's literally growing right outside their back door.
And you've put together a nonprofit organization kind of to that end to try to educate the public on indigenous foodways, right?
Yeah.
And give them more of an insight to some of these things that you've been studying.
Absolutely, because we really believe in Indigenous education and creating a space for that. So our for-profit business was the Sous Chef, you know, where we had a food truck called Tatanka Truck, and we've had a catering operation for the past few years, which we just sold a couple of summers ago. And we've been traveling around the United States and Canada and Mexico and doing lots of dinners and speaking engagements and conferences. But what we're really focused on is that nonprofit, which is called NATIFS, and it's an acronym for North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems. And this year we're opening up our first unit called Indigenous Food Lab, which is going to start here in Minneapolis. And we were hoping to be open by now, but the COVID crisis hit us really hard and we had to, you know, put it on pause for a little bit. But we're still locked and loaded, and we're going to be opening Indigenous Food Lab this year. And it's going to be a center where people will be able to come and try a food in a restaurant setting. But also, more importantly, there's going to be a kitchen classroom for people to take classes on Indigenous food system education and curriculum. So we're developing curriculum around seed saving and farming styles and wild food and ethnobotany and culinary techniques and food preservation and even other things like crafting and medicinals and language. And,
wow.
You know, all of it. We just want to create a center space for Indigenous-focused education.
Well, I'll tell you, if I hopefully I'll get a chance to make it out to the Twin Cities and check this out, because I really think that it would be an incredible experience. And I think it's great that, you know, you're not only being able to support, you know, in other Indigenous, you know, farmers and producers and whatnot, but being able to educate the larger public on something that, you know, they may not know anything about, and introduce them to, you know, these agricultural aspects as well as these different ingredients that, you know, maybe they've never come into contact with. You mentioned earlier, and I want to circle back to this about the recipes and some of these different kind of ingredients. You talked about, you know, sort of the foraging and wild ingredients and game meats. Give us some examples of a dish that you might put together with some of these unique ingredients that you found have history and roots in these North American and regional Indigenous foodways.
Well, it's really exciting to think about how much diversity there is out there, number one, because, you know, there's still 573 tribes in the U.S., 622 in Canada, and 20% of Mexico identifies as Indigenous. So there's a lot of Indigenous groups. And every few hundred miles, you're moving into a whole new different area. You know, it's a different language, different flavors, different religions,
right,
different everything. So what we do, we've been traveling around the United States a lot and exploring all these different flavors, and we just really try to make food taste like where we are.
Well, and you're in the Midwest, and that's what the show's about. So I definitely want to hear
Absolutely.
About those flavors.
Yeah, so when we are making foods here, we're using things like wild rice, walleye, rose hips, blueberries, wild tubers like hopness or sunchoke. And it's, you can literally just like stand in one spot in these forests and these Great Lakes regions and just look around and see all those ingredients right around you, you know? And so we're just really trying to make the food taste like exactly where we are. And there's so much, because the Western diet really doesn't touch so much of this plant life that's around us. And to be able to gain this knowledge of the use of all these plants and these flavors, and especially as a chef, to be able to explore hundreds of different kinds of flavors that are part of our landscape, you know, it's really exciting to come up with all sorts of recipes using that. And we can pretty much do it anywhere. So there's a lot to learn, and we're just looking forward to, you know, discovering a lot of recipes.
Well, and that has to be hard work and a sort of challenging process to, I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, I wouldn't even know where to start to try to identify, you know, and seek out all these different ingredients and seeds and plants and whatnot. I mean, what does that process look like to try to identify, you know, basically go back historically, identify these things, and then actually find them?
Yeah, well, basically, we just kind of mapped out what is an Indigenous food system and how do we apply it to all these different regions. So, you know, we've done Indigenous food dinners in Manhattan, where there's almost nothing Indigenous left there, you know, but we're able to know what kind of plants would grow there, what kind of wild food would be around and is around, what kind of seeds are still alive from some of the tribes nearby there, and what we can get from them, and the seafood and the animals. And we're able to put together all sorts of food and dinners and recipes recipes. So there's just a ton of stuff to explore. And, you know, we put out our cookbook, it came out in 2017, and we won the James Beard Award for Best American Cookbook in 2018, that following year. But it has over 100 recipes using only indigenous ingredients in the style that we do it. And it happens to be extremely flavorful and fun and, you know, super healthy for all of us.
That's awesome. And that's a great place for us to wrap up. What is the name of that cookbook so we can check it out as well?
Yeah, it's called The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, and you can find it online or ask
a local bookstore. Sioux, S-I-O-U-X, people.
Yep, S-I-O-U-X.
This is great. Sean, thank you for joining us. And I, for one, am going to come out and visit and learn more about these indigenous foodways, because, boy, there's a lot to learn and a lot to enjoy, and it really is the original threads in the tapestry that make up our Midwestern foodway. So thank you for sharing your experience, and thank you for your commitment to the indigenous communities across North America.
Thanks for listening to this special episode of the show and for sticking around to listen to more of my archived interview with Wisconsin food historian Kyle Cherik. You can see Kyle, Sean, and so many more from across the country on America the Bountiful, coming to a public television station near you starting in April. Check your local listings for dates and times or visit the PBS app for more. And you can check out even more content about the series on our website at AmericaTheBountifulShow.com.
Let's jump right into it and give us a bit of an insight, a 101 on when, why, and where German immigrants came to the Midwest. That's a big question.
These are great questions. A lot of people just sort of take this stuff at face value and assume, you know, it happened somewhere over the rainbow, right? So the Germans are really very similar to the original American immigrants of the sort of flawed story that we have about the Pilgrims, that they were religious refugees, and they were also part of the Dutch East India Trading Company, and that's who paid for the boats and things like that to go set up outposts, and then definitely pray the way you want to. The Germans that came over, the first wave was about 1839 to 1845, and then there was another one from the mid-50s until the 90s or so, and then there was another one right around the turn of the century. And just to put into perspective, relative to Germans in Wisconsin, so today, if you put the census down today, you would have 36% of the nation's populace in Milwaukee are German, and 42% of the nation's populace are German in the state of Wisconsin. So Wisconsin has got the highest population of Germans anywhere in the United States, and Milwaukee has the highest population for cities.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so we've been a German city. I mean, the first Germans came over to landed in Milwaukee and then went to central Wisconsin and some other areas that I'll talk about. But they came over in, let's say, 1846, when the city of Milwaukee was founded, which was 2 years before the state was even founded. So they were really the first and the biggest wave of immigrants to America, and then to Milwaukee and Wisconsin and Green Bay and Sheboygan and other areas like that. But they were the biggest wave of immigrants in America in the 19th century. And it was really primarily a water transport. They came over, once they came over in 1865, once the steamships really came in.
We'll be right back.
It cut
the
transport down to 16 days from 11 weeks. So just think about 3 months on a boat to get to a land that you have never seen before. I mean, the motivation, why would anybody put themselves through that if the motivation and the way of life that you're leaving really had to be pretty dire in many ways? And a lot of the reason why they settled in Wisconsin was, particularly central Wisconsin, really, really reminded them of their home country. There's a great letter that I have, some excerpts from just about the turn of the century, where a German woman is writing her sister, and she's talking about the huge swaths of land versus the little slices that they had available in Germany. And that was the truth. They came over, primarily they were craftspeople or farmers, and they could grow things here that they couldn't in larger quantities and with more freedom, religious freedom, than they could in the fatherland.
Right. Well, you've mentioned Wisconsin. What other areas of the Midwest were popular settling places for German immigrants across that region?
Sure. So you'll see some of them in Ohio, your state. You'll see some of them in Michigan. You'll see some of them in Minnesota. And then in Iowa, not really much down towards the southern states, Indiana and that sort of thing. They really, at least during that immigration period that I'm talking about, so like central 19th century through the beginning of the 20th, they really centered in that Midwest area. And it was the same thing that you and I would do. You basically went where you knew somebody or you heard good stories from someone that you trusted about that space. And so it just became a self-fulfilling prophecy that there were more Germans there because that's where the Germans went.
Right. Well, the Midwest is getting good PR. Obviously, the German community has left their mark on food in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that they came, many of them came particularly to Wisconsin because they saw it as similar to where they came from, you know, an agricultural community, yeah. But with a much greater, expansive, literally, like just more land. Is there anything that they brought with them, ingredients-wise, that they brought to the Midwest that maybe they introduced to Midwestern food that hadn't been there previously?
Sure. We really don't have any specific sort of thing. It was really more cultural know-how. I mean, the biggest through line, I guess, that you could call, the biggest through line that you could name in regards to that is actually not a German, but an Austro-Hungarian by the name of Agustin Harstady, who your Onophile listeners will know as the grandfather or godfather of California wine. He came over with vines that he had harvested and saved and packed from the Rhine Valley, which is like the Bordeaux of Germany. And he was looking for a place to establish great wine in America. And he saw the Sauk River Valley and founded Sauk City, and basically created the first vineyard. And after a number, I mean, he built caves and founded a city and put in a ferry and all kinds of really terrific things that are still there. The caves are still there, and it's still a working vineyard with a different name, Wollersheim. But that legacy, after a number of really tough winters, he realized it gets cold in Wisconsin.
It does.
So he packed up and he moved to California and basically founded the California wine culture that we have now. And then it's really kind of a funny thing, but the Holstein cow, before Germany was unified, there were all these different regions. And one of them, this northern region, which is where most of the Germans originally that came to Wisconsin came from, north and northeastern Germany, that region was called Holstein because, well, that was the name of the cows. The cows were bred between a black species and a white species from the Netherlands and from the German regions. And we have that iconic black and white spotted cow that is the Wisconsin cow, the spotted cow that's on, you know, the new Glarus bottle, that sort of thing. So they didn't really bring anything per se. They brought know-how, and they really brought their love of crafting great food, cheese and sausage and beer. Right. And as soon as they got here and they had the opportunity, they started making all three of those to a really, really high mark.
So you cheese, sausage, and beer. That sounds like the iconic trifecta of German food in the Midwest. So if there is one place or one specific dish that if you were going to the Midwest, Wisconsin and beyond, and you were looking for a traditional German meal, what would it look like? Let us taste that meal, but by describing it.
Sure. Well, I mean, I would, you know, it's a sausage-centric meal. I mean, the bratwurst that came, whether it was Bavarians and Pomeranians and that sort of thing, or the more North Baltic Germans, they just adore and love their pork. And it's such a deep, deep, deep tradition that's part of the German palate. And in Wisconsin, initially Wisconsin, German farmers or Dutch or any of the others all grew wheat. Wisconsin was the nation's biggest wheat producer up through the Civil War and just after. And wheat is also the most depletive crop you can grow. So after the soil was burned out, literally in came the pigs and the cows. and you know, all the big butcher names and Armour and Cudahy and things like that, they all started as initially with German butchers, essentially, then expanding their businesses and other people buying them.
Right. In some cases. So what you're saying here is that these kind of these household names that are essentially part of you know, industrial production, food production.
Oscar Mayer. I mean, you can't get more German than that.
Well, since I have you on that, tell us about that. Tell us about Oscar Mayer and their and the roots of.
So there was, you know, the pork barons of the 19th century, Oscar Mayer, Patrick Cudahy, who bought initially a German butcher shop, bought out his boss essentially. Sorry, I'm you put me on the spot and I'm spacing. There's another two or three.
Well, you look, it's you know, everybody knows Oscar Mayer. All we're looking for is a little bit of insight into how, again, Oscar Mayer wieners, the Wienermobile, the cold cuts, the hot dogs, how has that found its roots in, you know, German heritage?
Sure. So, you know, the Germans were different than many ethnic groups in that, yes, poor farmers came over, but many craftspeople and I would say intelligentsia came over during those immigration waves of the second half of the 19th century as well. And so it wasn't just the tired, beaten down, you know, sort of Statue of Liberty thing. They came over basically with a business plan in place, with the know-how, oftentimes with capital. You know, a steamship ride over at the turn of the century or before was about £3 in, you know, sort of steerage and up to £25 in sort of what we would call first class. There were some Germans riding in first class that were just saying, I want more opportunity in America, but I've got some money and I have some know-how. And you could raise animals. I mean, pigs, for instance, will eat anything and reproduce pretty, you know, quickly. And you have a built-in consumership in all of the German population. So it really isn't much of a stretch of imagination. I mean, go where the customers are, essentially, right? For a German butcher to then have a second shop and a third shop and a fourth shop and a fifth shop. And they would move on to, you know, then supplying other places. A lot of the German pork that was basically raised in Milwaukee and surrounding areas was shipped overseas. England consumed about half of the pork that basically Milwaukee and Wisconsin was producing because they had such a great demand for it. And that kind of wealth, when you're exporting through Liverpool and then the nation, I mean, it's kind of crazy, but if you were a British soldier garrisoned in one of the countries that the sun never set on the British Empire, there was a 1 in 3 chance that when you opened up your can of salted pork for your 3 square meals a day, that pig was actually raised in Milwaukee.
Midwestern food gone global.
I mean, I'm telling you.
We've talked about this as, you know, we've talked about the breadbasket of America, but it's really the breadbasket of the world too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So pork was, you know, I mean, the caliber of butcher and the style of butcher and the cuts that you can get, we don't think about it now, but this was really kind of a social standing. Germans and Milwaukee Germans would get dressed up to go out to buy the good cuts on certain days, relationships with the butchers, that sort of thing. Just as in Spain, where you walk into a great restaurant and they've got all those ham legs, right, hanging there, and that's a sign of a terrific restaurant. In the 1880s, it wouldn't have been uncommon to go into a really good German butcher shop and have 3 or 4 pigs hanging there and then great cuts dried and so forth, and to pay top dollar because that was a way of expressing your cultural acumen, essentially, and your version of wealth.
Right. So, I love these visuals because it does paint a picture for our listeners who obviously are hearing and not able to see, taste, or smell anything that we're talking about. And food and culture is such a tactile and visual experience. But you giving us these kind of descriptions are great. The one other thing that I want to mention here is something that I have noticed as I've done my research and have been doing interviews talking to guests for this show is there seems to be a trend line on the differentiations with immigrant groups by class and income. So you may, and how that impacts the food ways. And this is exactly what you're talking about. So yes, you may have, you know, German settlers, in this case, coming over that may be escaping religious oppression or looking for economic opportunity out of desperation. But mm-hmm. as you've just said, there are folks that are looking for economic opportunity because they're looking for the next big thing. And we don't talk about that much.
No. America was the land of milk and honey. And, you know, if you think about it, I mean, you could basically sail across the ocean. You could get into New York. You took a train to Buffalo. And then you got on, you know, basically something that took you through the waterways, the Erie Canal, to the very end of the Great Lakes. You could get off in Milwaukee, and then you had nothing but fertile soil for thousands and thousands of miles. And it was wide open. And if you had some know-how and a little bit of capital, I mean, that's just, and they were giving the land away.
Right.
You know.
We spent a lot of time on pork. I definitely want to talk about the German influence on cheese mm-hmm. and beer mm-hmm. specifically. So,
yeah.
And they're two of my favorite things, as you well know.
Yeah. I mean, the beer making goes back to, you know, it goes back to the Middle Ages. There's a beer that they brew in Munich, where I've been for Oktoberfest, called Optimator. And if any of your American audience knows the beer and they buy it, on the label it says, you know, brewing since 1016. And, you know, the first time I saw that, I had to double take like 1,000 years, basically. They've been brewing beer. And it's just one of the many breweries that are located within Munich's sort of city area. And the similarities between Milwaukee and Munich are actually, you know, when I went, you get a similar vibe. They both have a huge festival. We have Summerfest. They have Oktoberfest. Their massive park, their English garden, our lakefront, the architecture, the feel of the people. I mean, during my dad's generation, people talk about how walking through the streets of Milwaukee specifically, there would be signs in the window saying English spoken here because there were so many German businesses. And they wanted to be open to folks that just spoke English as well. So the brewing history that came over with people that knew how to brew as soon as they could get the requirements, we had plenty of water, right? So you got the barley and the hops and the other things, and you're off and going. And this was just sort of, someone that loves to brew beer can't be stopped. I mean, you experienced that when you met with Deb and Dan Carey. They're going to brew beer. Right.
Deb and Dan Carey, for those of our listeners who are unfamiliar, they are the family and the talent behind New Glarus Brewing in right. New Glarus, Wisconsin, that you can't get outside of Wisconsin because they are so committed to preserving the locally used agriculture and process there.
Yeah.
I've never experienced beer better than New Glarus Brewing. And I'm sad that I don't live in Wisconsin because I can't get New Glarus Brewing beer.
We recently had some people come up from, even during these corona times, come up from Illinois for something they were buying from us. And they bought a table that we had. And the next question was, where's a liquor store we want to buy some New Glarus beer? And if they were going to make the trip, that's the other thing they were going to get. But you're exactly right, Deb and Dan. You know, Deb was smashing her head against the distribution model and breaking into big cities like Chicago. And she finally said, people really appreciate good beer in Wisconsin. Why don't I just only sell it in Wisconsin? And Dan is a through and through born. I mean, I think he was born brewing beer when he was a kid. It's just something he was going to do. So these German immigrants that came over with that know-how, again, they had a consumership right there, right? They had a captive audience that would appreciate the beer. They had the know-how. They had access to great fresh water, grains through all the wheat that was grown here, hops, that sort of thing. Wisconsin had its own hops boom from 1870s to about the 1890s. And so you have all those components and you have, you know, Wisconsin's always been a place of gathering around the table and celebration. And I know you and I experienced that when you came, and it was such a great opportunity to show you some of that. But, you know, even in the 1860s, back when the state became a state, they did a census. And at that time, there were 588 innkeepers and 468 groceries. And the word grocery at those days really kind of meant like a delicatessen with beer and hard liquor. So it was more like a place to get small bites and then some drinks. And the word delicatessen, by the way, is a German word.
Right.
So, you know, when you think about the state's population, there were over 1,000 places where people could come together to get some rest, food, sustenance, and essentially celebrate. And, you know, that doesn't even include the beer halls and things like that. So it's such a Wisconsin thing, and it's such a part of our culture that, you know, I have to imagine from the very get-go, as soon as the fields were planted, they had just a little bit of ease in life. People started brewing and celebrating around tables and making great cheese as well, which is, you know, that comes in a little bit more from the Swiss and some of the Austrians and some other traditions. But there's definitely old German cheesemakers, too, because it was, you know, for the simplest of farmsteads going back to that 10, 15 or even further, it was a great food source and you could keep it, right? That was the good news. You could take your fresh dairy that day that would go bad and turn it into something you could eat 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 20 months down the road.
Right. Well, and there's always beer cheese and beer cheese soup, which is the meld of those two things, bringing all those Wisconsin flavors together. Kyle, you are a fantastic ambassador for Wisconsin food and for Midwestern food. And you've given our listeners great insight to how German and Germanic cultures live on in Midwestern foodways. So thank you again for joining us.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Warner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. You can learn more about the show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/Eat Your Heartland Out. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.